Kentucky Psychologist, a podcast brought to you by the Kentucky Psychological Association. The Kentucky Psychologist will get into the minds of top psychologists from Kentucky and occasionally friends from across the country. We'll talk about what leading mental health experts are interested in and excited about. Hear about all the ways psychologists in clinical practice, research, leadership, and applied settings are doing to improve and save lives. All right. Thank you all for joining us on this podcast episode, The Kentucky Psychologist. Today, we have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Bill Stoops. He is a professor at the University of Kentucky, and I'll let him take over and give a little bit of a short description about like what he does in his current position. Take it away, Bill.
Sure. So thanks, Sam. It's a real pleasure to be here with everybody today and talk a little bit about the work that we do. So as you said, I'm a professor in the Department of Behavioral Science here at the University of Kentucky. My background is I've got a PhD in experimental psychology from UK and have just stayed here and risen through the ranks to professor. My primary job at UK, I think of it as research. So I am a principal investigator in a lab with two other principal investigators where we do human laboratory and clinical trial research on addictions. We largely focus on stimulant use disorder, so like cocaine or methamphetamine use disorder, but we also do research on cannabis and opioids and alcohol. Beyond that, I have a couple administrative roles here at UK. I oversee our clinical research support office, which is sort of the central technical hub for clinical trial research at the University of Kentucky. Last is that I'm the associate director for clinical research of our substance use priority research area. So those are sort of the what fills up most of my day, in addition to mentoring and teaching and lots of other meetings.
Sounds like you're very busy. So on top of that, what do you do for KPA?
Oh, yeah. So for KPA, I'm the Federal Advocacy Coordinator, which for those of you who don't know, basically what that means is I represent Kentucky when it comes to central sort of federal advocacy initiatives, particularly that arise out of the American Psychological Association. So that will include virtual and in-person Hill visits. If you get those notifications about, you know, tell your congressperson about Bill X or your senator about Bill Y, that's coming from APA, and I'm working with KPA to get the word out about contacting our federal delegation.
So you briefly just touched on something else that you do. So tell us what you do for APA.
Okay, so for APA, like I said, you know, I've already talked about the being the Federal Advocacy Coordinator. That's a lot to say for KPA, which ties me into APA. But for APA specifically, I am on the Council of Representatives. I represent Division 28, which is Society for Psychopharmacology and Substance Use. So I'm the Council Representative. I am also an editor for an APA journal, Experimental and Clinical Psychopharmacology. I'm finishing up my term for both of those. So next year, it's possible I won't be doing anything for APA. I'll believe it when I see it. But that's sort of what I've been doing with APA recently.
It sounds like you might have some free time coming up in the next few years.
Maybe. We'll see.
All right. So can you give a quick like synopsis on like why or how you got involved with KPA? What made you stick around?
Oh, goodness. So, you know, I think what maybe folks don't realize about KPA is that it welcomes all types of psychologists. Right. You know, I think that a lot of people have this perception that a state psychological association really is focused on clinicians and clinical issues. And of course, that's a very key piece of what KPA does with working with the state, working with licensing boards, representing clinical and counseling, practicing psychologists in Kentucky. But KPA is welcoming of all psychologists, you know, people who are, in academia, who might consider themselves psychological scientists primarily, which is how I identify, but also psychologists who practice in non-clinical ways, right? That are consulting to businesses as industrial organizational psychologists or that area. So sort of more applied psychologists. That isn't true for a lot of state associations. So that was why I wanted to be part of KPA to really represent science in the organization. I felt welcomed. And that my perspective mattered, even though, again, I'm not a clinician. I don't practice. I don't directly help anybody. But that, you know, the KPA welcomed psychology, psychology researchers, psychological science, and is thinking about that. And so that's how I got involved, and that's why I've stayed around.
It's great to hear that. Like, you know, you find us so welcoming, and I hope other people find it the same way, because we try to be all encompassing of all types of psychologists across the state. So if we're missing anyone, please let us know.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I will say, I wasn't paid to say that. That's my actual experience. I certainly believe that about KPA, and it's really enriched my career, particularly to be better tied in with the state, and especially the state lobbying and advocacy pieces of what KPA does.
Yeah, so we'll quickly touch on that as well. So what brought you to being our federal advocacy coordinator? Like, what was the spark? Was it, you know, was it a Sheila Schuster? Like, what was the spark that brought you to this position that you're in now?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit serendipitous. So I had served on the APA Advocacy Coordinating Committee for 4 years. That term ended last year. And was doing a lot of advocacy stuff centrally for APA. And as the last KPA Federal Advocacy Coordinator was stepping down, I think Sheila and Eric and Georgianne all sort of said, well, Bill's already doing a lot of this work as part of ACC. Why don't we ask him about being the FAC? So, you know, of course, I got asked and was happy to do it. It's, you know, it's a workload, but it's a relatively light workload, considering how important it is that we really are connected with our federal delegation. And again, I was already sort of doing it, so I was happy to continue on and be able to maintain those relationships I've got with the staffers in our federal delegation.
We're definitely happy to have you in that position. So we'll bring it back a little bit. So what brought you to psychology? What was your first like aha moment of, I want to pursue psychology as a career? Like, was it like you knew immediately, or was it a different, you know, route? Were you pursuing something else? Like, where was it that where you were like, aha, psychology? Yeah.
So I definitely did not know immediately. So, you know, I went to a little school called Davidson College, which some people are familiar with, not everybody. Most people know it because of Steph Curry, but I also went there about 15 years before he did. But when I got to college, I thought I was going to, you know, be a French major and then go to law school and do international law, just because I was sort of where I thought I wanted to be. But I took a psychology class, Psych 101, and just was fascinated by it and thought, you know, because I hadn't had much exposure to that in high school. I didn't go to a high school where we had a psych, you know, like an AP psychology or anything. But I thought, oh, this is fascinating. So I quickly switched my major to psychology and was moving along. And I, you know, with a little school like Davidson, most people go on to some type of professional degree, right? They get their bachelor's degree and then they move on to medical school or law school. And so I thought, I'll go to law school. I knew I didn't want to be a physician. And so I thought I'll go to law school. And then I took some classes about drugs and behavior, behavioral pharmacology, drugs and behavior. And that really was the spark where I thought, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life, is I want to use psychological science to understand drugs and to, you know, of all kinds and sort of combat what we just assume about drugs, when really there's science behind what drugs do and how they act and maybe how we can treat people with substance use disorders. And so I thought, okay, that's it. I'm going to go get my PhD. And, you know, maybe this is jumping ahead, but UK is one of the very, very few places in the country where you can get your PhD in experimental psychology, studying the effects of drugs in humans. You can, you know, you can do that work in rats a lot of places. But UK was one of the few places, and I knew I wanted to work with people. UK was one of the few places where I could do that as a PhD student. And so I was really lucky that they let me in and that I was able to, you know, finish up. And then, like I said, I've stuck around. That was never the plan. I thought I'd, you know, get my degree and go on. That's what a lot of people do. But UK and Kentucky have been very, very good to me.
That's really, you know, an interesting, you know, journey you had to be where you are now. And I am one of the few people that know of Davidson College. So I will praise myself on that.
Yes, absolutely.
So as you were in this journey of psychology, what were some challenges that you faced in your career, or maybe you're still facing today?
Sure. So, you know, I think it's important to sort of acknowledge privilege. And so I certainly came into this with some privilege. You know, I'm a, I, I, I grew up in a family with where we had some means, and I was able to, you know, to go to college and graduate debt free. And I'm very, very thankful for that. So I didn't face a lot of the challenges that I know a lot of our colleagues have faced, but that doesn't mean that there still aren't challenges, right? Like, a couple things that come to mind, are the idea of staying here, right? So, typically in experimental psychology, people get their PhD and then they go on to a postdoc. Presuming they want to stay in academia, right? They go and do a postdoc somewhere else where they learn a new set of skills and then, you know, fight for that sort of academic, in that academic market for a position. I got some counseling advice that, you know, that's not everybody's path. If your path is to stay at UK, then your path is to stay at UK. And that's what I chose to do. And the opportunities were presented to me. Again, not necessarily a challenge, but I'm getting there. That means that I've sort of had to fight against the conception that he stayed at UK, he didn't really go transfer anywhere, he didn't learn something new. And actually, I'm relatively young for sort of where I am in my career. I just turned 45 in June. And so I've had to sort of fight against that, right? Like this person who's been here forever, and as good as UK has been to me, like there's, you know, there's still this conception, this person has been here for a long time, and he's, you know, he's relatively young, so should we really listen to what he has to say? And so those are some things that I've had to, you know, to think about. Minor challenges, I would say, compared to what a lot of my colleagues have had to face. And, you know, that's why it's been important to me to pay it forward to folks who've had sort of more challenges. I've, you know, benefited from really good mentorship and, you know, really a lot of resources. So anytime I can, you know, help somebody out, bring up a name when it's time to, you know, identify somebody to do something. You know, I've learned a long time ago that the people in the room saying other people's names is how you advance other people's careers. Is a really, really strong way to help people do that. So that's something that's been really important to me to do as well.
It's great to hear that you're paying it back. So I know everyone else is appreciating what you're doing and the work you're doing and helping them, you know, succeed in their career as well. So whoever's listening,
thank you.
You push up a bill. What is something that you're doing? Like, is there any research you're doing right this minute, or it's upcoming, or you've just done that was like super exciting?
Yeah. So this has been something that I've been pursuing, and we're just finishing up the first clinical trial, and we're working on a big grant to submit to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, who funds most of my research, to sort of continue this. But as a field, for a long time, we've thought about abstinence from drug use as the only outcome that matters, right? That if people want to be in recovery, that what that is abstinence 100% of the time, forever and ever and ever, ever, right? And that is a wonderful goal to have, but that's a really, really lofty goal. And I think that we as a field have sort of hurt ourselves by saying that's the only goal, that, you know, that we kick people out of treatment if they aren't abstinent. And I'm saying we as a field, not, you know, any one person. I certainly am not providing treatment or kicking anyone out of it, but that we as a field dismiss the chronic relapsing nature of this disorder when we're thinking about treatment. Right. And so I've been working for the past 5 or 6 years, and we're finished. Like I said, we just finished up the trial. Folks are in follow-up now, where we're looking at non-abstinence outcomes in cocaine use disorder. So looking at reductions in cocaine use, looking at health outcomes that we know are associated with cocaine use, like heart health or psychosocial health, and whether those can be reasonable outcomes for people to achieve beyond just abstinence, right? And so that's something that I'm very, very excited about. The field is starting to get there. And I'm excited that we're sort of on the leading edge of that. And we're working, like I said, on a new grant. We have no idea whether it'll be funded, but really focused on that idea in methamphetamine use disorder. And it's a big grant. It's what's called a P50 or a center grant. Really focused on translational research from rats out into the community, on these non-abstinence outcomes, just to try to be more patient-centered, to be more all-encompassing in how we think about what recovery from substance use disorders looks like. So sorry for running on, but that's really the thing that I am so interested in. And as a field, I think we need to go there. And I'm trying to push us there a little bit.
No, I love hearing your passion about it. It makes it like seem like that's more about your work. Like you're passionate about it. You're really gonna see this through. So that's it. Such an exciting thing. Who, maybe who, or what were some of your prime influences to help shape you as a person and a psychologist or a researcher today?
Sure. So I need to start with my family. I grew up, you know, in a really wonderful, supportive family who, you know, basically, you know, said, you can do whatever you set your mind to. So do it. Right. And so just a really, really supportive family. And especially my mom, you know, I lost my dad about 20 years ago. My brother passed about 3 or 4 years ago. So just my mom and me. And then, you know, I've got aunts and uncles and cousins who are great, but a really, really supportive family, is the very first piece of it. And then, you know, I have a few academic mentors who I would love to call out for what they've done for me. So Mark Smith, who was a professor at Davidson College very, very early in his career, I started taking classes with him. He's the one who taught those classes that really put me onto that, you know, the idea of studying drugs. So Mark is one of them. And then when I came to UK, I did my PhD with Craig Rush, who I actually now share a lab with. And I did my postdoc here with Sharon Walsh. Many people may be familiar with her because she's really done a lot of work around opioids and opioid treatment in the state. So those are sort of a lot of my sort of primary academic mentors who've shaped me. But I've also really benefited from this idea of peer mentorship. I've got really a great group of friends who are here at UK, around my age, around my career stage, who also have been really helpful in me conceptualizing, what I want to focus on in research and how, what kind of academic I want to be, right? What kind of professor I want to be and how I want to teach my classes and how I want to approach my research. That's really been a key influence in my life. Just the wonderful colleagues and friends I've developed here at UK and outside, but you know, the folks at UK are the folks you see most often.
Yeah, that's awesome. You have a great support system that's been, you know, there from the beginning to where you are today.
Yeah, very, very lucky.
Can you give us a quick, you know, little blurb, maybe, you know, what do you do away from work? Like, what do you like to do to like kick back, relax?
Yeah.
What are some of your hobbies? Do you have things, places to vacation? What, you know, what does Bill like to do outside of your work realm?
Well, and I want to say, like, I'm not the best with work-life balance, but I definitely absolutely, you know, think that you have to have a life outside of work. I think there's a lot that I like to do. So at most mornings, I get up very early. You know, people who know me know that you might get an email from me about 4 or 5 in the morning, because that's when I'm getting up. I promise I don't expect you to be responding at 4 or 5 in the morning. But then I go on a run. I run 3 or 4 miles. I am not a marathoner. I go very slow. But, you know, that is sort of when I solve all my problems and all my issues, when I've got a question I'm wrestling with is on those runs. You know, I love a Netflix binge as much as anybody else. Any new shows that show up on Netflix are probably going to be on my watch list for a weekend. I am a reasonably good cook. So I don't have folks over the way I used to since the pandemic, but I do like to cook for people. And then the last thing is I love to travel. You know, I travel a lot for work, but I try to make, you know, add something fun on top of a work trip. But, you know, every year, my mom and I take a trip. So in a couple of weeks, we're going to fly into Montreal and get on a boat. Her sister, my aunt, and me, are going to get on a boat in Montreal and go around the, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and then wind up in Boston, right? Because that's what they wanted to do. And I said, that sounds great. I just did a trip to Seoul with some friends, and totally not work related. Now they're people I know from work, but not work related at all. We didn't go for work. So travel is really, really an important thing to me, to see the world and you know, sort of better understand, you know, those new and diverse perspectives.
Do you have a favorite place of where you've traveled?
Oh,
is there one that's like top notch, or like a couple that are like, you know, in the top five?
So that's a hard question, but Iceland is actually the favorite place I've ever been to. I have been there twice. I can't wait to go back. Like I dream about okay, when I go back, here's the thing that I'm going to do that I didn't do before. And I've even thought about retiring there, right? Like, it's just, it's such an incredible, incredible place. And it's not that far from here. It's, you know, a 4 or 5 hour flight from Minneapolis, right? And maybe six, but still not a really, really long flight. You know, there, you can fly across the continental United States in that time. So that is my top one. I would say absolutely go, especially as climate is changing. You want to get to see those beauties of Iceland, hopefully before they change too much.
Yeah, you sold me with a quick flight. That's number one for me. So exactly. Quick flight to Iceland, then you'll see me on it. Do you have any unique approaches to your work? Like, is there something like specific in like your research that like you do specifically that like maybe your other colleagues don't do? Is there something like unique about your research focus or your approach to your research?
Sure. So, I mean, I think that I'll start with something that I think is unique to UK and part of what keeps me here. And then I'll talk maybe a little bit about how I approach my work that might be a little different than how other people do it. So, you know, I started the podcast off by talking about, you know, I'm trained in experimental psychology. I do human laboratory and clinical trial research. And I talked about how UK is one of the few places where you can come and get your PhD studying giving drugs to people. And I, you know, should probably refine that a little better. You can, you know, you can do work with cigarettes or alcohol or even cannabis in graduate school at several other places. But at UK, again, it's one of the few places where you can study a drug like cocaine or methamphetamine or various opioids in human beings. And there's a whole ethics and science behind this that we may be can get into later, and we take it very, very seriously. But that is something that UK is one of the few places in the world, not even just the country, the world, that you can actually do that type of work. So that is a unique thing and a unique strength we've got here at UK. Now, I think in terms of like how I think about things, I've got a lot of friends who are thinking really deeply about sort of the mechanism and taking a given phenomenon apart, which I think is really, really, really important. I've never been that kind of guy who's like, okay, let me get deep down into this mechanism and really delve into it. I've always been more of a big picture. I think about the clinical endpoint. So I think maybe that's where I'm coming from for the non-abstinence is, what is the clinical relevance of what it is that I'm asking these people in the laboratory to do? Right? Like how is this ultimately going to help somebody? And so I think that's something, I don't know if it's unique, but that's something that really dominates my thinking. I will also say organization is my secret superpower. So like I'm able to get things done early and stay organized. And that is something that I rely on. And that I'm so thankful that I just had that sort of innate ability or innate desire or whatever it is, just to be sure that things are organized and neat and tidy. And that if something, you know, unexpected happens, you've planned for it by being organized and doing things ahead of time.
I think organization is 100% a superpower. So embrace that. I love that 100%. Like that is phenomenal in everything else you do, but organization, I love it. So we've always talked about like the opioid use, drug use on humans. Is there any other like research interest that you have, or is that like your all encompass?
Yeah. So, you know, all the work that I'm funded to do, and that is my primary interest really is focused on substance use disorder, right? Like, trying to identify novel treatments, trying to understand, you know, what novel outcomes we could have, those kind of things. So that really is my primary research interest. But I'm also really interested in clinical research, period, right? And so I oversee our clinical research support office. So that gives me a really nice broad view of all the clinical research that's being done on campus. And so I get to see, you know, things from new molecules to treat cancer out to sort of behavioral interventions for depression that might be happening here at UK. And so I'm just fascinated by the diversity of perspective that clinical researchers are bringing to really advance new treatments for any number of human ailments. And so I get I get really excited when I see sort of these new things coming online, both at UK and nationally. But, you know, and for, in terms of sort of specialization in what I'm doing, I really do focus most on substance use disorders. And that, you know, I think that tends to be how the, you know, sort of the environment shapes our behavior, right? Like if you want to be an academic scientist, more often than not, you're going to be focused on one area because that's where you're going to get funded and where you're recognized as an expert or have, or that you have expertise. And, you know, for better or worse, being sort of more broadly focused in my experience has not been as successful.
Yeah, that's completely like that. I get that 1,000%. Like you're in this niche area and now you are going to be labeled as an expert. And like you get to add that to your title. Like you get to add that to your LinkedIn. I'm an expert.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Even though imposter syndrome is real and I experience every day and I'm thinking, am I allowed to make this decision? Do I actually know this thing? And so for folks who are listening who are early career, like just know imposter syndrome is real. You'll learn how to navigate it and you just sort of go on.
Yeah, that's awesome. So are there any like side projects you're working on, any like pro bono work outside of your, you know, substance abuse stuff, outside of your advocacy work? Is there anything else that you might do on the side?
Sure. So, you know, I mean, a couple things I would mention, and this is not something I do all the time, but I again, going back to the idea of it's really important to give it back and it's really important to teach people about the science of substance use disorder, because again, there's all these preconceived notions about what that is, right? About what drugs do, but we actually have science that tells us about what drugs do that we can share. So I will often, when asked, you know, particularly by, you know, public defenders or folks sort of who are working on behalf of people who are part of the legal system or the criminal justice system and might have substance use disorder issues going on, I will often consult for those folks. My favorite thing to do in that arena is be what's called a teaching witness, which I didn't even know what was a thing, but have been approached by folks mainly here in Fayette County to write, you know, to just like, I sit in front of a jury and a judge, or I've sat in front of a jury and judge just like every other witness, but I'm not like, I'm not testifying necessarily about fact one or fact two or those kind of things. I have been up there being asked questions about like, so what does this drug do? And what might we expect that this drug would do? So it's not so much about that defendant or that, you know, prosecutor or whatever, but it's teaching everybody in that room what we know about these drugs. And I think that's really important. So I always really try to, when I get asked by press, when I get asked by people in the legal system, again, particularly I really like to do this for folks who are public defenders, to share my knowledge in a way that I think people, you know, sort of a lay public can understand it. Cause that's the other piece is we can talk real science-like, right? And that just can get lost on people. So it's important to be sure you're bringing it to where people are.
Yep. That's such a unique thing that like you get to do and you like break it down in layman terms for all these people. And like, you know, I would never think that like that would be a position, but here you are doing it. And like, people probably don't know that exists, but you're doing the work.
I'm trying. Yeah.
Do you have a mantra or a saying or a quote that you like live by either in your research or in your day-to-day life?
Oh yeah. 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 And so this is a quote I found on Twitter. So bear with me. And you know, I think the last time I went to look at it, the Twitter account that had said it doesn't exist anymore. So I don't really know, like, so I'm not sure exactly how to attribute it, but basically the idea is that we in academia, we in science are all smart, right? Like that goes without saying. You can really distinguish yourself by being kind, right? And so I think that's something that I really try to do. I'm not always successful, but I try to be as kind as I can be to those around me. Right? Like I don't feel like I need to prove that I'm smart. I've got some letters behind my name that probably support that I am. What I have to prove myself is as a kind person and somebody who wants to help people. And that tends to be my mantra. I also really like, you know, to think about how can I be as honest as possible and upfront with people as possible, while still being kind. Right. So those are the things that I, you know, try to come back to every single day as my, you know, sort of guiding principle or approach to things. Again, it's hard sometimes to do that, but I try.
So everyone listening, just be kind, be a kind human being, and absolutely, they might take you places.
We would be a lot better off if everybody tried to be as kind as possible. So
wouldn't we? Yes. So obviously you're doing all this amazing research and on, you know, the opioids as substance. You know, is this one of the ways that you think psychologists are making the world a better place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, there's so many problems right now. You know, I mean, we've got a mental health and addiction crisis, which is where I think of myself as working. We've got problems with climate change. We've got social justice and inequity and disparities, right? There's just all this stuff going on that is so problematic and so daunting. But I think that psychology and psychological science has a lot to say about all of that stuff, right? And this is not to lessen the contributions of other areas of science, but I can't think of a profession where we have so much ability to comment and improve these issues that the human condition is faced with, right? And so we can make the world a better place by using our science, by using our voices, by using our kindness and our knowledge to speak to all of these issues and to not be afraid and to have hope that there's better ahead of us. Now, that doesn't always work. People don't always want to listen to science. People don't always want to listen to knowledge. But we have psychology stuff, psychological science to speak to that too, right? How do we get people to actually listen to science? And so, and I didn't know this going in. You know, I just thought it was cool to study drugs and behavior and people. I thought that was neat and interesting. And, you know, only as I've sort of matured in my career have I realized how much we as psychologists can really help people. Particularly how much we have to say about, these major issues that we're faced with.
That's awesome. Like, there's a bit of psychology almost in every element that
there is. Know, we there touch, is, right? Yeah.
Yes. So we're about to wrap things up, and I have two questions for you. One you don't know about, but this one we'll wrap up with here. What is your best advice to those just beginning their career in psychology?
Oh, goodness. So, I mean, I think if you're just starting off, and I've talked about this a little bit, there's so many options. There's so much you could go into. I think that if you're starting off in psychology, if you're an undergraduate student, a graduate student, you know, make sure you survey the field and figure out, you know, really where you think you might want to be, right? You know, like, just as my example, I started off with Psych 101. I thought, this is all really cool and I'm going to be a psych major. But then I really took my time and took a breadth of classes rather than a depth of classes when I was in college to really sort of get a sense for what psychology was. So I think, you know, don't be scared of that breadth. Experience it. Think about where you might be and where you might want to specialize, because like ultimately you're going to probably have to specialize, right? But have those experiences and make the decision to go in the direction that you feel best about, right? Like, if it's being a clinician, right, then, you know, go get that degree in counseling or clinical psychology. If it's being a scientist, then go get that degree in experimental psychology. If it's you want to consult and you want to make businesses more effective and efficient, then go become an IO psychologist, right? But there's so many directions you can go in. Try to experience as many as you can and then make a decision.
Don't rush it.
Take your time.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And enjoy the journey.
I think the other thing that there's a place for you here, right? Right. There's a place for you in psychology, no matter which degree you have, no matter if you don't have a degree, no matter, right? There's a place for you and for your interest, because again, there's such a breadth and there's so much that psychology can speak to.
Love that. So anyone listening, don't give up. Try everything, put your toe in all the things, and then jump in.
That's right.
So last question. Okay. I'm asking everyone this. So if you've listened to the podcast, you know which one it is, but if you were to be put on stage for karaoke today, what's your go-to song?
Oh my gosh. I have not listened purposefully because I was like, I know this is coming up. And I was like, I don't want to have too much of a preconceived notion. And I'm stalling here just a little bit. But I think it would probably be, and I do it very badly. Let me be very clear. Hard to Handle by the Black Crowes. And I think it's Otis Redding is the original one, but I do the Black Crowes version.
I love that. That is a great choice. Great choice. I absolutely love that. All right. Well, that ends all the questions I have for you today, Bill. I appreciate you taking the time to be on this podcast. And I hope you all enjoy this episode. I'll link all of Bill's socials that he has and his email in the show notes. So again, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome.